Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. Excuse me. And we didn't get a chance to actually get into the Constitutional Convention and the notes on it, but we ended up diving into this, I'll just call it a long history of our rights, the Constitution, you know, as citizens and so forth. And it really had to do with the 23andMe breach and how they're starting to finally disclose all of those compromises. But anyway, let's dive into this Constitutional Convention. Welcome back, Paul. And so
thank you.
And so one of the things that I think is really, really important, and I'm going to basically start this off with this before we actually get into the meat of the convention, because as soon as they kick off, there is a proposed plan. And so that's what we're going to start off with, is the proposed plan. And that actually came forth on Wednesday, the 30th, of May. Okay. Now, on the 29th of May, I'm just going to kind of read through this. John Dickinson and Eldridge Gerry, and the former of Delaware and the latter of Massachusetts, took their seats. The following rules were added to the committee: that no member be absent from the House so as to interrupt the representation of the state without leave. Now, we already know that this actually got violated because Hamilton left. The committees do not sit whilst the House shall be or ought to be sitting, and no copy be taken of any entry on the journal during the sitting of the House without leave of the House, and the members only permitted to inspect the journal. That nothing spoken in the House be printed or otherwise published or communicated without leave, without permission.
Okay.
That a motion to reconsider a matter which had been determined by a majority may be had with permission, they say leave, but with permission, unanimously given on the same day which the vote passed, but otherwise without any other previous notice in what case. So, I mean, this was the course of one day.
Okay.
You know, this is what Madison recorded, that this very first day before they really got into the Virginia plan, and there's actually other things that they talk about, how they organized and who was being selected, and Washington was selected as the president of the convention. But getting to this point, the day before they really kind of weigh out that, hey, you know, that there's only going to be one person that's going to take notes, that nobody else can write, publish, or do anything, that it's all going to be kept in a journal, and this journal is to be kept secret. Now, I know what you're probably going to say is that, you know, how did Madison, you know, write these notes? Well, Madison had to have written these notes. So I'll get into this a little bit further, because as a matter of fact, Governor Morris, or Pinckney, moved that the committee be appointed to the superintendent the minutes. In other words, Pinckney basically said that the committee would take care of the minutes. Mm-hmm. And then Governor Morris objected to it, that the entry of the proceedings of the convention belonged to the secretary as their impartial officer. The committee might have an interest and bias in molding the entry according to their opinions and wishes. See, okay. I mean, even back then, they were trying to make sure that what was being recorded wasn't recorded with a level of bias.
Okay.
And the motion was basically negated with 5 no's and 4 yeas. Go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, Madison was not the only person that took notes of the convention. In fact, I believe even Hamilton may have taken notes. So was Madison the secretary?
No. I believe it was Livingston or something like that. I mean, I'd have to go back to the Constitution because I believe that the signing of it kind of revealed all of that. And so Article 7 right here, George Washington, the president, and at the very bottom, I think they identified who the secretary was somewhere in here. William Jackson, secretary. So Jackson was the secretary. And he did a terrible job. As a matter of fact, I believe the journal disappeared.
Wow. And so if it weren't for Madison's notes, we really wouldn't have the history of how this went.
Yeah. And okay, so they wanted to have this secretly done at the time. The whole point of keeping the journal and to keeping this record was to be able to provide the people, you know, with this unbiased report. That was the whole point of doing this. The reason that it was maintained secret at the time was they didn't want disturbances, murmurings, and that type of stuff to start going crazy.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, if you actually had, if you watched, and as a matter of fact, a good case in point is I think it was Chile. The Chile still, I don't think, has hammered out their constitution because it's wide open. And, you know, it is being done in a democratic form. As, you know, they say something, the people reject to this. They reject that. They reject this. And they can't get anything done.
Are you saying Chile does not yet have?
They're trying to rewrite their constitution. At least they started this in the early, late teens or the early 20s of 2000. And they started this convention, and they've just not had any success because they're going about it in an open forum, fully transparent. I mean, it's give these people a chance to go off and actually, you know, create a constitution and then come back with ratification. But the way they're acting, it's like, you know, by the time we're done with this constitution, it'll be fully ratified already. Right. And you can never get there because you're always going to be going back and forth between all the different factions of, oh, I want this. It kind of goes down the path of if you've ever been to a convention over a platform for a party, the more people you have in that platform discussion as delegates, just as delegates, not everybody, but just as the delegates, the harder it is to come to a final product. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because we're not equally informed. Mm-hmm. And back in these days, these men were equally informed. And they agreed pretty quick to doing what had to be done. Because they'd already tested and tried other methods. And they knew that you get too many cooks in the kitchen, it spoils the food.
So, and you know, the documents we've read up to this point show that they're equally informed. They're using terms, they're using vernacular and statements that are so similar from the beginning. And this is not just one state, this is state to state, that they've been discussing this for a really long time.
Right. Okay, so Madison's notes, now he injects these little points. And so he writes these notes down, and then, you know, he has little sub-references for himself. Mm-hmm. And he has it in his mind. And actually, I think that this was, you know, started with this noble intent. And I believe that after some time after the Constitution was ratified, because he hadn't been married yet, mm-hmm. when he finally realized that, you know, he wasn't going to publish these notes, that, you know, it was really just something for him. And it wasn't, I think, until he was married that his because what he didn't want to do was he didn't want people to see these notes to taint how the Constitution was defined.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want these to supersede the ratification debates.
Right. Did he actually say that? Yes, he did.
It was in a letter to John G. Jackson. He said, "I'm not these things won't be done until after I die. But if you want to understand what the Constitution means, then you have to read the ratification debates." This is a compact, and it falls under the tenets of compact law that, you know, it's not what any person thought the Constitution to mean at the time of the writing of the Constitution. What mattered is how the states were sold it, how it was defined to them. So now we're getting ready to go into the next day. But before that, so they kind of said, okay, we're going to do this. And now, before we really start doing anything to say, well, where do we start? Governor Randolph gets up and he presents a plan. And so let's go ahead and start with, he expressed his regret because prior to this, Madison basically says insert new notes and resolutions. Sure. And he kind of has that in the following as far as his notes as he was kind of keeping this. So go ahead.
Okay, so he actually put these notes somewhere else because he's got some things
yes.
in brackets.
Here, uh-huh,
right?
Yep.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right, so Mr. Randolph then opened the main business. He expressed his regret that it should fall to him rather than those who were of longer standing in life and political experience to open the great subject of their mission. But as the convention had originated from Virginia and his colleagues supposed that some proposition we expected from them, they had imposed this task on him. He then commented on the difficulty of the crisis and the necessity of preventing the fulfillment of the prophecies of the American downfall. He observed that in revising the federal system, we ought to inquire, one, into the properties which such a government ought to possess, two, the defects of the Confederation, and three, the danger of our situation, and four, the remedy. Before we go on,
okay.
let me say something here. He,
uh-huh.
he said something that struck my attention. He then commented on the difficulty of the crisis, the necessity of preventing the fulfillment of the prophecies of the American downfall. What was that about?
So it was prophesized by Britain and other nations that America, you know, would basically, you know,
not make it.
They're not going to be successful. They looked. So just let's be clear here. When you look at America, there was some similarities to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at America, there were 13 sovereign states. They operated and functioned very differently. The only thing that they had in their advantage over Europe was they were of the same tribe. Let's just say that.
Okay.
When you look at Europe, there were some very distinctive differences between, you know, the difference from, let's say,
oh, yeah.
the Italy and the Mediterranean area. There were those
right.
cultures from Greece to Italy, right? Greece in the far east and Italy to the far west of the Mediterranean. And
right.
then when you started migrating north to the French and to the German, and there was a division between the French and the German, and there was even greater division between the German and, let's just call it, the Scandinavian North, right?
Right.
And then we had Britain, which was a complete outlier.
Right. So what we had a common language and a common outlook, and on top of that, the states had fought a war together for their liberty. So there was some level of unity that just didn't exist in Britain.
Yeah, so when did Genghis Khan march through Europe?
I'm thinking between the 500s and 700s.
It was like a millennia prior to this, but let's look at what happened. When Genghis Khan came through Europe, did Europe unite?
I don't know that they did.
No, they didn't. They did not unite. It's not like all of a sudden they all bonded together to actually stop him, which is why he succeeded, which is why almost every war, the world wars have started somewhere, and it started in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, there's a game called Stratego that kids played, and I played it as a kid.
I played Stratego.
And Europe was always, you know, the weak point.
The hotbed, right?
It was the weak point of the world because there were all these different portals in and out of it. And to control it, it was almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, when you look at the resources of nations and so forth, America, because it was isolated, had the greatest opportunity. Asia was another one, but I'm just saying that 9 times out of 10, America would always win based on stratego. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just saying that when we look at Europe and this prophecy that was coming from the European monarchs and, you know, statesmen and so forth, most of them thought that America would fail. You know, there was one statesman that actually saw, you know, a shining star in the Americas.
Who was that?
That was Adam Smith.
Okay.
The Wealth of Nations. He understood economics, and economics being all things at that point in time for government.
Mm-hmm.
That, if, you know, if the people, which the body of government was the people at that point, not corporations. And so when we look at, you know, what Adam Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations, he said, hey, if these people can actually, you know, effectively move their commerce, you know, from the, you know, the interior to the to their exterior ports and bring it, you know, send it out and bring it back to them, you know, more efficiently, they can actually beat us at the game here, because they got all these rivers, they got waterways, and they have, you know, this unity where we don't have that.
Right.
Right. I mean, look at some of the rivers, like the river that goes through Germany, the Rhine or whatever. Mm-hmm. That, you know, Germany does have a seagoing port, but that's up in the Arctic.
Right. Wow.
So anyway, let's just go ahead and get into the character of the government that he wants to talk about and everything else. Okay.
So the character of such a government ought to secure, one, against foreign invasion; two, against sanctions between members of the union or seditions in particular states; three, to procure to the several states various blessings of which an isolated situation was incapable; and four, to be able to defend itself against encroachment; five, to be paramount to the state constitutions.
Two. Okay, hold on here.
You want to finish this?
Okay. Yeah, no. So what is the very first thing that they're worried about?
Foreign invasion.
There you go. They want to make sure that they're going to protect this American culture.
Mm-hmm.
This body of people that came here. Now, what is number four?
Number four is to be able to defend itself against encroachment.
There you go. Again, what's different between four and one?
They're very close, except, well, against encroachment. So foreign invasion, there may be something specific. Foreign invasion and encroachment,
uh-huh.
You know, encroachment could be economic.
Well, no, so encroachment right here, mm-hmm, is the federal encroachment into the states. In other words, the states didn't want the foreign or the federal government to invade them either.
Okay.
That the states maintain their sovereignty, right?
Yeah, when it says to be able to defend itself, it doesn't seem to specify the states, but I can understand that.
Now you see, so right. So the number three, to procure to the several states various blessings of which an isolated situation was incapable. In other words, they can't be isolated.
Right.
They have to have this union. And so, you know, he's basically trying to paint this picture, but the number one thing is this invasion. And then they wanted to make sure that the federal government could not basically invade or take away the sovereignty of the states.
Right. Okay.
So it created, when you really look at it, they created this bubble, that this, mm-hmm, union operated within this bubble, and the federal government was to, mm-hmm, guard the sovereignty of each of these states from, mm-hmm, external influences, as well as from, you know, because they talk about this, to procure the several states various blessings of which an isolated situation was incapable. In other words, they couldn't be isolated, but they needed to be secured, so that other states couldn't actually start wreaking havoc.
Right.
So anyway, keep going in the number two.
Okay. In speaking of the defects of the Confederation, he professed a high respect for its authors and considered them as having done all that patriots could do in the then infancy of the science of constitutions and of confederacies. When the inefficiency of requisitions was unknown, no commercial discord had arisen among any states, no rebellion had appeared as in Massachusetts. Foreign debts had not become urgent. The havoc of paper money had not been foreseen. Treaties had not been violated, and perhaps nothing better could be obtained from the jealousy of the states with regard to their sovereignty.
Okay, so he's talking kind of in a negative mode that things didn't happen, but he's actually identifying the things that did happen.
Okay.
Okay, so as you go through this, because he's first kind of, you know, the first three lines, he's kind of talking about, you know, he's offering respect to those folks in the room and to those family members of those folks who signed and worked on the Articles of Association. Mm-hmm. Do you know that there was one man in this room that actually signed both and worked in the Articles of Association as well as the Articles of Confederation?
No, I don't. Who
Roger Sherman.
Okay.
So Roger Sherman was the guy that was involved in all three. I mean, so this guy...
Did he sign the Declaration?
I'm not sure. He might have. I've got to go back. But I do know that he was involved in the forming of the three governing documents. And so there may have been other people, but I know he was the one that was in all three.
What, you said the three. So the Articles?
Of Association, Articles of Confederation.
Right.
And he was sitting in this convention for the Constitution. So... When we look at, he basically, Governor Randolph was talking about this, you know, whole, you know, thing was done, you know, in kind of a rush. And, you know, we didn't have some experience. You know, we had, let's just put it to this way. You know, you can have all the text knowledge, you can have all the academic knowledge, but until you get into the lab, or actually until you get into the real world and start applying these principles, you really don't know what the results will be. I mean, you're operating based on these books and texts that they all read and they were all equally informed on, right?
Right.
So as they move forward, it's basically he started saying, hey, when the inefficiency of requisitions was unknown, no commercial discord had arisen. Well, actually, right. Commercial discourse had arisen. And when they say any states, no rebellion had appeared, as in Massachusetts, but foreign debts had not become urgent. The havoc of paper money had not been foreseen. So he's talking about these things, but that was actually happening. Right. That he's basically saying that they didn't know at the time that this is what was going to happen because they didn't do a good job in forming the Articles of Confederation. We already went through the amendments to it.
Sure. And I understand what he's saying. Essentially, he's saying these things didn't happen yet, but we didn't realize what we're going to wind up with.
But now that we see behind us, right, now
right,
we actually
sure.
looking, these things actually happened because they didn't know what to do with that Articles of Confederation.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so
hey.
I want to make it really clear, so you've got less than a minute.
Okay, all I wanted to tell you is Roger Sherman did sign the Declaration of Independence, and he was 72. Okay?
Okay.
So he signed everything.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Okay.
Right.
Number two, I guess we'll wait till after the break.
Well, actually, we did number two. He then goes into the next to enumerate the defects. So this is what he's going to go into.
Right. But you're right.
So what I was just trying to lay it out that, you know, he was trying to methodically hand carry everybody into this point moving forward that, hey, you know, we've had some problems. The only reason we had these problems is because, you know, we didn't have a crystal ball. We didn't have, you know, God revealing to us that, you know, what you had just created in these Articles of our Association and Confederation were inept and inadequate. And bottom line, we now experience all these problems, and now we have to form a constitution to deal with all of these different problems. And so... Now he's going to get into the proceedings of the defects, additional defects, with the Confederacy when we come right back after this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so heading into the break, we were kind of talking about, you know, how there were these deficiencies, but actually, you know, that was really kind of just an overview of a good political approach and trying not to make sure we're not offending anybody to say, you know, who would have thought, you know, when we signed these confederations that we'd actually have a seditious rebellion like what happened up in Massachusetts, you know, and these are the problems, you know, the runaway of paper money and all of these things. So now he says that he then proceeded to enumerate the actual defects of the Articles of Confederation. Now, just okay. keep in mind. Madison was the master, right? He was the puppeteer.
Okay.
Is that what you call the guy that's controlling the puppets or the
Yeah, that's the puppeteer, but he's the guy that knew the end from the beginning. He knew where he wanted this to go for the most part, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things I think is really important that I love helping people understand, Madison was the author. I mean, Governor Randolph already basically stated that we were the initiators of this convention.
Right.
Right. Did he not say that already?
Okay.
Yeah, that it originated. He says right up there at the very beginning of his, he expressed his regret that it should fall to him rather than those who were of longer standing in life and political experience to open the great subject of their mission. But as the convention had originated in Virginia and his colleagues, Virginia. Right? So,
right.
And so he's basically saying James Madison. Now, Alexander Hamilton was in the room, too, and because he couldn't get any traction in New York, it really had to come from Virginia.
Right.
In some ways, you know, Hamilton, and keeping in mind, by this point in time, I believe he had already become a spy for Britain.
So, real quick, that's why was it that he couldn't get traction for this in New York?
Well, because New York and Governor Clinton was not sympathetic to magnifying the Union. He was happy with this, you know, awesome state with the Hudson River and, you know, all of this potential that they had. You know, they had created, I mean, they had already, you know, procured the Manhattan Island. And I mean, they have grown New York into a very bustling city and port.
Okay. So here's my follow-up question. Is that the reason that the Federalist Papers were aimed at New York?
Primarily, yes. Primarily, okay. Yes. Well, the Federalist Papers were really for the New England states.
Okay.
Why? Because they were reading papers. How many people in the South do you think read papers?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Not very many. Okay. Even though the Federalist Papers were circulated out to many of the press, there was a censorship of the anti-Federalist Papers. But for the most part, when you really look at, you know, the states that had this problem. Okay, so we already gone through the ratification debates. So we already started seeing this divide.
Okay.
And so this is why, you know, there were a lot of states in the North that said, you know, we don't want to be a part of this union with those people that have slaves.
Okay.
And so that's one of the reasons why in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, you're going to actually hear the words uttered that this Constitution will eradicate slavery by its design.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear people in the South basically selling it otherwise. Hey, we have 20 years of protection over slavery. We think that over time we're going to be able to actually maintain and that the Constitution will start embracing this. Mm-hmm. They think that the idea of slavery is going to grow again in the United States. Right? I mean, so seeing that, and you know, we have that advantage of having read the ratification debates and what they were saying. And, you know, obviously we're armchair quarterbacks here. Like, we wouldn't make the mistakes. But anyway, the point is that, you know, this is all like the preface. And now he's really going to start getting into the defects as who saw it. And what I was trying to point out is as Madison saw this. In other words, you know, I don't think Morris had much time. He may have, you know, collected some of his thoughts and amended to what Madison gave him. But for the most part, this whole plan came from Madison.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
I forgot to say this, though. This is the whole reason why I went down this rat hole. As we look at what Madison projected, out of all of the great men that you know, how many great men, when their idea is rejected, you know, and they pursue something else and something else becomes adopted, how many great men have you known that actually embrace and not only embrace, imbue what was agreed upon instead of basically saying, we should have done what I suggested. We should have done what I, you know, I submitted.
So let me make sure I understand. So he submitted a plan, but if I understand correctly, it got modified.
It was rejected outright. It was actually rejected. And, if you know, then there were a couple of other plans. And then ultimately there was this morphing of this government into a new hybrid, you know, Republican form of government that Sherman basically presented in the Connecticut or the Sherman Compromise. So, I mean, this was
which Madison actively embraced and defended through his life.
It was, so actually, Madison was so open. He was just happy to have the convention. And as we go through this, I think that he was probably awestruck at, you know, the profoundness of how things progressed into creating this document, which is, you got to remember, this guy had a theological background. And I think that he probably recognized, you know, the divine nature of this, the course that the convention had taken.
Right.
And I think that, you know, when you're a part of something like that, you really have to be, a humble man to allow the spirit and those things to work through you. And I see that Madison just imbues this stuff. And I'm going, wow. I mean, he's never proven to be the guy with sour grapes. We should have done it my way.
Sure.
Never. Not at all. He just did. That was not his character. And Hamilton did everything he could to go down the path. He was being paid to be, you know, manipulative in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway.
Okay.
All right.
So let's see what we've got here. So now, he then proceeded to write the defects, right?
Yep.
One, that the Confederation produced no security against foreign invasion, Congress not being permitted to prevent a war, not to support it by their own authority. Of this, he cited many examples, most of which tended to show that they could not cause infractions of treaties or of the law of nations to be punished, that particular states might by their conduct provoke war without control, and that neither militia nor drafts, being fit for defense in such occasions, enlistments only could be successful, and these could not be executed without money. 2. That the federal government could not check the quarrels between states, nor rebellion in any, not having constitutional power nor means to interpose according to the exigency. 3. That there were many advantages which the U.S. might acquire, which were not attainable under the Confederation, such as a productive impost, counteraction of the commercial regulations of other nations, pushing of commerce ad libitum, etc., etc. 4.
Okay, so nowhere is he saying that this federal government needed to control the sovereign states in any way. He's really talking about protecting them and, you know, keeping the peace between them, as we have been saying all this time. So keep going. Thank you.
Okay. That the federal government, this is number 4, could not defend itself against encroachments from the states.
And so when you read the Federalist Papers, you know, there was a lot of talk that, you know, the federal government could be encroached. And there was a lot of talk about, you know, how the states could, you know, kind of pervert or, you know, basically take over. And that's not what really ended up happening. And as a matter of fact, when you read Federalist Paper number 49 regarding the encroachments and using conventions as a methodology in, you know, stopping an encroachment from one branch to the other, it was never really projected. It was, you know, not that it wasn't thought of, but it wasn't projected in the Federalist Papers that the federal government would ever take over the states.
Right. It doesn't even say that here. It seems like they're concerned about the opposite.
Yes.
The states encroaching on the federal government,
right.
Which
uh-huh.
I don't know that that's happened. Okay. Number 5, there was not even paramount to the state constitutions ratified as it was in May of the states. Am I reading that right? What does it mean?
That's probably just a short note for him.
Many of the states.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, that should be many.
Okay.
Okay, so let me see. That it was not even paramount to the state constitutions ratified as it was in many of the states. I think that's just a typo.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So that was, those were the defects.
Right.
All right. And then you want me to go on, right?
So, yeah. And then so he covered the defects and he's just kind of glossing over. But now go ahead.
OK. He then reviewed the danger of our situation, appealed to the sense of the best friends of the U.S., the prospect of anarchy from the laxity of government everywhere and to other considerations. He proposed as conformable to his ideas, the following resolutions, which he explained one by one.
Okay.
Go resolutions ahead. Proposed by Mr. Randolph. So here we go. Just a minute. Number 1. Resolve that the Articles of Confederation ought to be so corrected and enlarged as to accomplish the objects proposed by their institution, namely, common defense, security of liberty, and general welfare. 2. Resolve, therefore, that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned to the quotas of the contribution or to the number of free inhabitants as the one or the other may seem best in different cases.
Okay, so
in this case,
right,
they have not yet gotten to representation of the state.
Yeah, actually they did. If you read this suffrage, that's exactly the national legislator ought to be proportioned to the quotas of contribution. In other words, based on population, you know, each state would have, you know, representation based on their population.
No, yeah, that's not what I meant. I meant that the Senate that wasn't even in their radar.
Correct. Correct. Actually, Madison wasn't making a huge conversion of Continental Congress. What he was suggesting here is that the representation in Continental Congress would be not equal as it is in Continental Congress, right? Because at that point in time, Continental Congress was really more of a Senate. All the states had equal suffrage.
Right. Okay.
And now he's suggesting that they apportion or have the suffrage based on, you know, the members or the population of each state. That's what he's suggesting here. So go ahead.
All right. Resolved that the national legislature ought to consist of two branches. Resolved that the members of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states.
So you missed one. Did you read two? Resolved, therefore, that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature. Yeah, actually, you did.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. You're
okay,
right.
That's okay. Three, resolved that the national legislature ought to be consisted of two branches. Four, resolved that the members of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states every blank for the term of blank, to be of the age of blank years at least, to receive liberal stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States except those peculiarly belonging to the functions of the first branch during the term of service for the space of, you know, however many years after its expiration, to be incapable of re-election for the space of blank after the expiration of their term of service, and to be subject to recall. Five, resolved that the members of the second branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by those of the first out of a proper number of persons nominated by the individual legislatures to be the age of blank years at least, to hold their offices for a term sufficient to ensure their dependency, to receive liberal stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, and to be eligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States except those peculiarly belonging to the functions of the second branch during the term of service and for the space of blank after the expiration thereof. Okay, just a minute. All right, I want to stop here because it sounds like Resolution 5, members of the first, Resolution 4, members of the first branch are being elected by population. It sounds like the members of the second branch are being elected by the members of the first branch. Does that?
Resolved that the members of the second branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by those of the first, yes, out of a proper number of persons nominated by the individual legislatures.
Okay.
In other words, the state legislatures will nominate those people who will occupy, you know, the second branch.
And the first branch will elect them.
Yes. And so I believe that it was perceived that the bigger states, because they would have the, you know, the more votes in the first branch or this in this first body, that's the larger body, because it's based on population, that that body would basically lean more towards favor of those coming from the larger states. Okay. In other words, the second body would probably be void of any of the smaller states.
Correct.
Because they just wouldn't get the votes. Okay.
Yeah. Good. Okay.
All right.
Sure.
So, okay. Resolution 6?
Resolution 6. Resolved that each branch ought to possess the right of originating acts, that the national legislature ought to be empowered to enjoy the legislative rights vested in Congress by the Confederation, and moreover, to legislate in all cases to which the separate states are incompetent or in which the harmony of the United States may be interrupted by the exercise of individual legislation. To negative all laws passed by the several states, contravening, in the opinion of the national legislature, the Articles of the Union, or Articles of Union, and to call forth the force of the Union against any member of the Union failing to fulfill its duty under the Articles thereof.
Okay, so here he's basically saying that the national legislature would have negative powers over the state legislature in some of the things that they would do.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And that wasn't received very well, but keep going.
Resolved that a national executive be instituted to be chosen by the national legislature for the term of blank years. to receive punctually at stated times a fixed compensation for the services rendered, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the magistracy. They've used a word magistracy here. Existing at the time of increase or diminution, and to be ineligible a second time, and that besides a general authority to execute the national laws, it ought to enjoy the executive rights vested in Congress by the Confederation.
Okay, so they were basically creating now a national executive. Now, explain to me how this is any different than currently. You know, based on the Articles of Confederation, did they not have a president?
I believe they did.
Okay. And that president was really more of a figurehead that the Senate, or I should say the Continental Congress, controlled everything.
Right.
And so he's basically saying that we're basically going to keep the exact same thing.
Well, the other thing he says, apparently, is that the representatives will elect that executive.
Yes. In other words, that's how it is currently. In the Articles of Confederation, the president, like John Hancock, was one of the presidents of the Continental Congress. He was elected by the body of Continental Congress.
Right.
Now, the one unique thing was that the body would create a second body. The Continental Congress would create a Senate, for a lack of a better word, a second body of legislatures that would be selected by the nominations of the states, so that the second body would have, you know, some role that he hasn't disclosed yet. But bottom line, the national legislature is, and I think that may be the first, because he's not breaking in, you know, in differentiating between the first and the second. Maybe it's both. I don't know, but I do know that they're the ones that would select the president, not the people.
Right.
Or the people's electors. But anyway, keep going.
All right. 7, resolved that the national executive be instituted to be chosen by the national legislature for the term of blank years, to receive punctually at stated times a fixed compensation for the services rendered, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the magistracy, existing at the time of increase or diminution, and to be ineligible for a second time, and that besides a general authority to execute the national laws, it ought to enjoy the executive rights vested in Congress by the Confederation. Okay.
Okay.
That's for the executive.
That's the executive. Okay. Now there's a national judiciary, because remember, the Articles of Confederation did not have a national judiciary. So go ahead.
Okay. Resolved that the executive and a convenient number of national judiciary ought to compose a council of revision with authority to examine every act of the national legislature before it shall operate, and every act of a particular legislature before a negative thereon shall be final, and that the dissent of the said council shall amount to a rejection unless the act of national legislature be again passed, or that of a particular legislature be again negatived by blank of such members of each branch. This is interesting, because it sounds like they're giving the – it sounds like, let's say, something is passed in the legislative branch, then it goes to the judiciary. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Now, well, and it's a council, not a Supreme Court. It's just a council that is looking at the laws coming from the legislature and saying, nah, in other words, the veto power goes to the judiciary.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. 9, resolved that a national judiciary be established to consist of one or more supreme tribunals, and of inferior tribunals to be chosen by the national legislature to hold their offices during good behavior and receive punctually at stated times fixed compensation for their services, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the persons actually in office at the time of such increase or diminution. That the jurisdiction of the inferior tribunal shall be to hear and determine in the first instance, and of the supreme tribunal to hear and determine in the dernier resort. All piracies and felonies on the high seas, captures from an enemy, cases in which foreigners or citizens of other states applying to such jurisdictions may be interested, or which respect the collection of the national revenue. Impeachments of any national officers and questions which may involve the national peace and harmony. Okay, number 10.
Okay.
Resolve that provision ought to be made for the admission of states lawfully arising within the limits of the United States, whether from a voluntary junction of government and territory or otherwise, with the consent of a number of voices in the national legislature less than the whole. Okay. 11. Resolve that a Republican government and the territory of each state, except in the instance of a voluntary junction of government and territory, ought to be guaranteed by the United States to each state. Resolved that the provision ought to be made for the continuance of Congress and their authorities and privileges
until a given day after the reform of the Articles, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I lost my place. Okay. Privileges.
Continuation. So they're basically saying that a provision ought to be made for the existing Continental Congress to be able to, maintain itself until after a certain day of the reform of the Articles are adopted.
Okay.
So in other words, they're basically trying to accommodate the process of transitioning from the old government to this new government. But it's not that big because, see, Continental Congress isn't changing.
Right.
Okay.
All right. 13. Resolve that provision ought to be made for the amendment of the Articles of Union whensoever it shall deem necessary, and that the assent of the national legislature ought not to be required thereto.
Okay.
So what they're saying is, it's not up to the national legislature, of course not, okay, to approve amendments. It's up to the states, okay? That's what I'm guessing here. 14.
Right. Resolve, so in other words, it's not changing too much.
Okay.
Okay.
Resolve that the legislative, executive, and judiciary powers within the several states ought to be bound by oath to support the Articles of Union. And 15, resolve that the amendments which shall be offered to the Confederation by the Convention ought at a proper time or times after the approbation of Congress to be submitted to an assembly or assemblies of representatives recommended by the several legislatures to be expressly chosen by the people to consider and decide thereon.
Okay, so right here, he basically had presented this Virginia plan, and now, it's getting to the very end of the day, and Mr. Pinckney, because, we can kind of read through this, but let me go with Mr. Pinckney said, laid before the House a draft of a federal government, which he had prepared to be agreed upon between the free and independent states of America. Mr. Pinckney's plan ordered that the same be referred to the committee of the whole appointed to the consideration of the state of the American Union, and then they adjourned. So in other words, he kind of presented something, and then they, had to adjourn. And so what happens is all of a sudden an interesting twist is brought forward, and we're going to cover that tomorrow. So folks, as you can tell, we're kind of laying out this whole progress of how they started in making minor changes to the radical changes they ended up doing. And I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.